Com.
Standard of Paranormal Radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
This week, our co-host is Nick Redfern. Paul Kimball will be joining us later. Our guest, finally, we got him here, Richard Dolan, on the PowerCast. He's author of two books so far under the broad title, UFOs and the National Security State. Volume 1 is an unclassified history, which covers 1941 to 1973. Volume 2, which became much larger, is 1973 to 1991, subtitled The Cover-Up Expose. Now, before we get into what the cover-up is and more details, for those who haven't heard Rich on the PowerCast, the first thing we ought to focus in is how did you come to write these books? Because I gather it sort of became a much bigger project than you anticipated, Rich.
Yes, it did, Gene. And by the way, thanks for having me on, and greetings to Nick. I started doing UFO research a little over 15 years ago now, back in the early mid 1990s. At that time, I was doing fairly conventional type of Cold War research, a doctoral dissertation focusing on the Harry Truman presidency. I think it was in 94, and I kind of stumbled into the UFO topic really in two different ways. One was in a bookstore. I saw a book by the author Timothy Good called Above Top Secret. I had never seen this book before. It was subtitled The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And I remember watching, looking at the cover, thinking, wow, that's kind of interesting, and flipping through the book and becoming intrigued. I was intrigued, I think, because he was writing in large part about a lot of the people in the era that I had been focusing on and so on, but he was working this into a UFO context, and that was a bit jarring to me. I bought the book, and I found it very, very interesting. And really, my main question early on was not what are UFOs, but rather, is this a genuine part of our history? And if it is, even if it was a mistake, even if these 3 and 4 star generals were interested in this by some kind of mistaken belief, why had I never read about it in any academic book? Because after all, I should think that that's still important. And I also got interested in the UFO topic around the same time by trolling around on what was then the internet, basically the bulletin board groups on Usenet. There is one main one that I used to go to, Alt Paranet UFO. I think it's still around. I haven't been there lately. But back in those days, before there was much in the way of websites, there were people who would be posting up information that was, you know, relevant to UFOs. You know, after getting past the typical flame wars that were going on then, just as they do now, there were always a lot of people who had some pretty interesting things to say. And those two things, by the mid-90s, really got me hooked. And really what I wanted to do initially was not write a book. The main thing I wanted to do initially was just satisfy for my own curiosity what I thought about the UFO topic. Did I think it was legit or not? And that morphed into what became a 500-page book, UFOs and the National Security State. That writing that book was really my initial attempt to answer the question for myself, what did I think of the UFO phenomenon?
Now, just approaching this here, you started out conceiving a 2-volume set.
Right.
And then as you were working on Volume 2, obviously it kind of got away from you, I suspect, very much like government spending is. And there's a story that's out this week about the sprawling security apparatus of the USA that I'd like to talk about in a few moments.
Yeah.
But it became a 3-volume project, right?
It did, yeah. There was just too much information, truthfully. I started writing the second volume. So I was doing what I thought was just going to be the second and concluding volume of this study. It occurred to me that Chapter 1 was 100 pages and Chapter 2 was about another 100 pages. And I thought, this is going to be a 1,000-page book. So there's no way, no way that I could make this work with that amount of quantity, so I just decided I was just going to split it. And really the perfect point to split it, I felt, was at 1991, which is the end of the Cold War, really the end of an era. And that worked out great. That was a 600-plus page book, and it was perfect.
Now, of course, Volume 3 is going to come eventually.
One of these days, indeed.
And how far are you going to actually focus, just whatever year you write it in, or what?
That's right, Gene. I really believe whatever the day that I actually finalize the book, I hope to have the topic covered as well as I can up to that point.
Let's look at the broad aspect of where we're going with this. UFOs and the national security state implies that there are national security issues in the presence of UFOs here. So far in your investigation, your research, where do you think we can pinpoint these national security aspects?
Well, I think first and foremost, we can pinpoint them in the officially released government documents that show airspace violations as being a kind of a big concern. What we know, going back to the 40s and 50s and 60s, and really even through up to our own era, is that we have a consistent history of U.S. military aircraft, and indeed military aircraft of other nations as well, chasing objects that behave in ways that are not supposed to be possible, that are not identified, and that often look in a very unusual ways, like disc shape, for example. So that doesn't prove that UFOs are alien or ET, but it does seem to prove to me that there's a phenomenon going on that begs an explanation. And it has national security implications, because when you have instances of objects being seen over sensitive airspace, not once, not twice, not a dozen times, but many dozens of times that we know of, then clearly that's important if you can identify it, and if you're sending your own interceptors up look after it. So I would say, yes, that's a national security concern, and this is something that we know was going on in the 40s and 50s and indeed beyond. What we don't have, of course, is an official explanation from, let's say, the powers that be as to who's responsible for it.
Now, over the course of writing this book, and we should cover both volumes 1 and 2 since they're both available and I have them in front of me, and I've read a lot of them despite what some people have suggested. Okay, where do we see government involvement other than basically being participants, witnessing sightings, sending up aircraft, scrambling jets because they see a sighting? Are there any other instances or aspects of government involvement we should be knowing about or concerned about?
I'm not sure where you're going with this. I guess, you know, certainly we've got the long history of the various types of government-sponsored investigations into UFOs. Maybe that's what you're thinking of.
I'm thinking also about overt involvement in terms of researchers, dirty tricks. Paul Benowitz is an example.
Oh, well,
like
yeah,
that.
Right. Well, one of the things that I've argued in my second volume in particular is that the UFO phenomenon sort of came to a head, as it often does, in this case in the late 1970s. And what really had happened, as I see it, is that the Freedom of Information Act, which really only had got some teeth really in the mid and late 1970s, resulted in the release of thousands of pages of documents relating to UFOs from many branches of the U.S. military and the U.S. government, CIA and FBI and a lot of the military branches as well. And in particular, it was interesting because, you know, all of those agencies basically had been saying for years, well, we don't really investigate UFOs. The FBI had said it. The CIA had said it. And then suddenly, researchers were, due to FOIA, were getting some pretty good documents.
And, of course, they're talking about here, Rich, they're saying, we don't have any of this stuff, we don't investigate it, but they nevertheless have the documents. We have Richard Dolan, and he is author of two books of the UFOs and the National Security State series, a third book coming eventually. Our co-hosts this week, Paul Kimball, Nick Redfern, I'm Gene Steinberg, you're in the PowerCast.
what's going to happen next.
As you know, the PowerCast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks. With more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers, for listeners of the PowerCast, Audible.com is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One book to consider, for example, is Above Top Secret, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up by Timothy Good. Timothy Good, as you know, has been a guest on the PowerCast.
Yet another book worth considering from Audible.com is Lies and Deception, UFOs and the Secret Agenda, from Timothy Good once again, and also from our old friend Nick Pope. As you know, Nick Pope has also been on the PowerCast. This is another book that you're definitely going to want to check out.
For this book or another free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/powercast. That's audiblepodcast.com/powercast.
Originally, we the people have entrusted government to be the guardians of currency, to ensure purity, content, weights and measures of gold and silver coins citizens would use for commerce. This reinstalled confidence after the demise of the fiat continental system, wisdom being lost with time. The government we once entrusted to protect from counterfeit has colluded with private business, creating the largest fiat counterfeiting scheme our country ever experienced. This is not only a transfer of power to an institution that is not accountable to our elected government, but has also caused the dollar to lose more than 90 cents of its original value. Now foreign governments are trying to divest themselves from this once world reserve currency. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. I'm offering a book that explains how the system works. Call me today at 800-686-2237. I will give you a silver dollar free just for purchasing the book. Call today at 800-686-2237. Again, that's 800-686-2237.
If you suffer from poor sleep, you've got to try MyPillow. Introducing the most revolutionary, most comfortable, and coolest pillow ever, MyPillow. Imagine your very own custom fit pillow. MyPillow is the only pillow of its kind on the market that uses a patented fill, custom made to your exact individual needs. MyPillow is 100% made in the USA and has a natural built-in cooling effect that keeps your cervical nerves cool, and that helps you get the best REM sleep possible. MyPillow helps alleviate snoring, migraine, sleep apnea, and other sleeping disorders. MyPillow is antimicrobial, non-allergenic, dust mite resistant, machine washable and dryable, comes in many sizes and will not go flat. And best of all, MyPillow comes with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what do you have to lose except poor sleep? Go to MyPillowShop.com, mention coupon code GCN and receive up to $40 off. That's MyPillowShop.com or call 952-442-6199. That's 952-442-6199. MyPillow, for the rest of your life.
What is a wind generator?
How can the wind produce power for a small cabin?
How can wind energy be stored and used during an emergency?
Can I assemble my own wind generator?
For answers to questions about wind power, visit windbluepower.com. Did you know the wind could provide your family with emergency power? It can with a wind generator from windbluepower.com. Learn how our amazing LifeBreeze wind generator kits start charging a 12-volt battery and just 6 mile per hour wind. Or see the new Cyclone X2 dual kit featuring two wind generators on just one tower. And learn why schools and universities across the country utilize our products to teach about wind power and alternative energy at windbluepower.com. All kits qualify for a 30% IRS tax credit for residential energy efficient property. Enter coupon code RADIO for a 5% discount at windbluepower.com. That's windbluepower.com or call 800-976-0026. That's 800-976-0026.
How do you spell hard-hitting talk radio?
GCN.
The Genesis Communications Radio Network.
We want to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com. Get in on all the action at forum.theparacast.com.
I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the Paracast. We have Richard Dolan joining us. Some months back, he came out with Volume 2 of UFOs in the National Security State, subtitled The Cover-Up Exposed, and we're going to try to do that. Our co-hosts this week are Paul Kimball and Nick Redfern. Nick, why don't you pick up on the questioning?
Well, sure. I guess one of the questions that kind of occurred to me as Rich has been talking about how, you know, he initially got involved in the subject, not like a lot of people, as someone who has a UFO experience, but coming across the subject and then beginning to learn more about it. I just kind of wonder how, when the penny dropped, so to speak, and the realization hit home that this is a real phenomenon. I mean, did that kind of galvanize you? Did you feel this story needed to get out there because people just weren't fully aware of it?
There were a couple of little epiphanies, Nick, that occurred to me. And in fact, it's somewhat related to what I was just about to discuss anyway regarding government documents. One of the key early documents that I read that really got me energized is a famous one among researchers, and that's the Twining Memo of 1947. I'm sure many people listening have heard of it, but for those who haven't, it was a document written by a then 3-star general, Nathan Twining, who later went on to get 4 stars and became Air Force Chief of Staff. And in 1947, Twining was answering a request from another general, Charles Shulgin, relating to the status of these flying saucers. Shulgin had asked, basically, is there anything that I need to do about this? What is going on with these flying saucers? Twining wrote back a memo, which had a lot of detail, and he repeated a lot of the statements that were being collected by military agencies describing the characteristics of these disks. And the key thing that Twining said to him was that the reported phenomenon is real, not visionary or fictitious, and then went on to describe the characteristics of it as reported by military personnel. The characteristics were quite fascinating to me. Silent or nearly silent, evasive upon being sighted, well-kept formations of flight. And one of the key things he said was a flat on bottom, domed on top in terms of the shape. I asked myself what objects in 1947 would be flat on the bottom and domed on top. Nothing officially that's supposed to exist. So I remember reading that in around 1994, thinking, well, that is interesting. And at that time, as I mentioned earlier, I was deep in the heart of studying U.S. Cold War strategy of exactly that period of time, late 1940s. And I thought, if they were truly interested in this, well, that's the part of the historical record, and it's very interesting. So that was a key moment. As I discovered, that's a completely legitimate memo, and there are many others of a similar type of nature that were equally compelling.
I guess, you know, based on the fact that your book is very historical in nature, you know, you go back to the early days, one of the things I've found, and I wonder if you've found this as well, is that many people who are new to the subject are sort of woefully ignorant of the very good, strong history of the subject. You know, I don't know if you get this, but I get a lot of talk at lectures and conferences asking about Area 51, alien autopsy.
Oh, God, yeah.
Things really that surfaced, you know, in the last 10, 15 years.
Right.
And I get a lot of blank looks when you start picking out names from years gone by. And that's what I liked about your book. And I just wondered how important you feel it is to sort of put it in its whole context, you know, the important history from the early days.
Well, it was the fundamental reason I wrote the book, Nick, truthfully. I recall thinking, still when I was in the early research period of this book, before I had really written any of it, I've always had a theory about any subject, which is that there should always be a good 500-page book that deals with the subject in all of its important facets. I'm sure all of us have a lot of 500-page books on my shelf dealing with this topic or that nation's history and so on. And I thought there really ought to be something for the UFO field. And looking around and really not finding one to my satisfaction, I did set out to try to write that. I do feel that losing our history is always something we have to be careful of. And I wanted, at least to the best of my ability, to write a clear, reasonably comprehensive and reliable history of the phenomenon that would be useful for people today and for people in the future.
Okay.
I mean, just so that we don't forget the history.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I guess just as a fellow author, I mean, did you get the sort of response from the readers, so to speak, Was that what you expected? I mean, did you get, you know, sort of intriguing comments? I mean, did you get any sort of official interest, that sort of thing?
When I was writing the book, I wrote it almost completely by stealth, as I used to sometimes say. I mean, nobody knew who I was. When the book finally appeared in mid, really, it started appearing in late 2000, about a little over about 10 years ago. I think people were, a lot of them were very surprised because they'd never heard of me, and this was a fairly substantial book. I was hoping that I would get positive feedback. I didn't really know how that would work out. I was pleased by a lot of the feedback that I got from some people who had government background, some scientists who had a lot of intelligence community background. A number of them wrote to me saying, hey, great job. You got a couple of things wrong here and there, but overall, I love your book. I was very, very happy when I got a real thrill when I first wrote to the astronaut Edgar Mitchell, trying to get one famous person to endorse my book. I thought, I just want one person who's really well known who will put in a good word for me. And it was a, I considered it a Hail Mary pass to get Dr. Mitchell to even look at the book. But fortunately for me, he did, and he said it was. He liked it, and I was able to get an endorsement. Actually, I got that endorsement out of him about a week before I had to finalize the book to get it to the printer. I think I was in danger of becoming a serious pest to him, but he finally relented and said, yeah, just go with the quote. That's fine. I wanted his quote on the front cover, no question about it.
Well, I guess a NASA astronaut quote, you can't get much better than that. So.
Well, it was absolutely the best that I was able to get, and I was happy to get it. Absolutely.
Well, that's cool. Okay, good.
Yeah.
And, you know, having written two very extensive volumes now, I mean, where do you feel we're at, you know, in terms of, yes, we're getting the information out there, but to what extent are people listening? And more importantly, to what extent do you think we're making a difference or able to make a difference in terms of hopefully resolving the issue one day?
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's such a hard question to answer. The UFO field has often, we're just perennially set apart from the rest of society in a lot of ways, in the sense that we've got very dedicated, loyal readers, people who are very dedicated into the topic. But there continually is this failure to break through to a large mainstream audience. I do see that changing a little bit in the last few years, not in terms of books so much as through film and television. I'm thinking of James Fox, who's been able to make a number of appearances on the Larry King Show. There have been a few television venues in which some intelligent and serious researchers have been able to make their case.
Okay, we'll get into more of that in a moment. We have Richard M. Dolan and our co-hosts this week, Paul Kimball, Nicholas Redfern. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the PowerCast. Okay, neighbors, here's the problem. Face-to-face business meetings with clients and colleagues are always going to be important. But business travel is a hassle, and it's often a complete waste of money. Well, here's a solution for you. Do more, travel less with GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is an award-winning online meeting service brought to you by Citrix. With just a click, host sales presentations, training sessions, or product demos right from your own desk. Avoid the hassle of traveling and still exceed your sales goals. Plus, GoToMeeting is just $49 a month for unlimited online meetings. Plus, voice over IP and phone conferencing is included. My listeners can try GoToMeeting free for 45 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com/podcast. Once again, GoToMeeting free for 45 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com/podcast.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Remain in your houses. The President of the United States has declared martial law under Executive Order 11004.
Will they do it? Will they pull the trigger this time? We all pray they stand down, but an engineered crisis seems more likely with each passing day. Think it can't happen here? Executive Order 10990 locks down all highways. Executive Order 10995 seizes control of all media outlets. Executive Order 10998 controls all farms and food supplies. All these executive orders are now cocked, loaded, and waiting for the right crisis. So if you're worried about the possibility of martial law here in America or have questions about how to survive it, go to martiallawsurvival.com. That's martiallawsurvival.com. Go to martiallawsurvival.com right now.
You must remain in your houses until your bracelets are scanned.
Question. What would you rather drink? Acidic water which burns holes in your body and causes loss of bone mass? Or alkaline water which promotes high energy and vibrant health? The answer is clear. And if you're drinking acidic water, you're helping cancer cells and bacteria to grow out of control. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops combine a unique formula of the most alkaline minerals. Using Plasma pH Drops is the best way to alkalize your water and help you get rid of acid and regain your health and energy. Simply put 10 drops in the water you drink to raise the pH to a healthy alkaline level. Most experts agree that the water you drink should be at a pH level of 8 or higher. Disease organisms like bacteria, viruses, or cancer cannot survive in an alkaline high pH environment. Order your bottle of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops now by going directly to AlkaVision.com. That's AlkaVision.com. Or by calling 269-409-1776. Again, 269-409-1776.
Tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more.
I just want to hear more of it.
We are the GCN Radio Network.
This is Leslie Kane, and I'm with the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and you are listening to the Paracast.
I'm Gene Steinberger in the Paracast, co-host Nick Redfern and Paul Kimball. Our guest is Richard M. Dolan. Paul Kimball, you have the floor.
Excellent. Well, this is the moment everybody's been waiting for, I'm sure, and I'm not going to ask Rich about UFOs. Instead, I want to ask you, Rich, about, we'll talk about UFOs in a minute, but I want to ask you about the other part of your book's title, because it is UFOs and the national security state. Perhaps you could talk a bit about the national, what do you mean by the national security, leaving aside UFOs, what do you mean by the national security state? What should your readers understand that as a concept in sort of the broader picture of how our society is structured? Perhaps you can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, great question. Thank you for asking it, Paul. I do see American society, and really global society in general, as having evolved over the past century, without a doubt, in terms of how the governing structures are situated. So the United States was founded over two centuries ago explicitly as a republic, something that was in opposition to the concept of monarchy. The American Republic has had a long history. It's gone through a lot of changes and permutations. I would argue, and certainly not alone in this, I hope, that since the Second World War in particular, the form of the U.S. government has gone through some changes that have really weakened and maybe even mortally wounded the traditional republic that we, many of us, have grown to love or learn about in school. So what is it that we actually have? What form of government do we truly have? When I look at the United States government, I see a sprawling apparatus that's dominated more and more every year by an unanswerable intelligence community, black budget, special access programs, and the like. And so what do we actually have? I'm not sure if classical political philosophy has given us a proper name for it. but it's something other than a republic. And so calling it a national security state, I think, is descriptive. It's a state that, along the lines of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, when he warned about the dangers of a military-industrial complex, I think the national security state is something along these lines. It's not quite government. It's not quite private. It's a sprawling nexus of both of those things.
Well,
that still nevertheless take tax dollars along the way.
I remember once having a conversation, I think when I first met you, which I believe was an Aztec many years ago when I was doing the Majestic 12 film, and you were kind enough to be interviewed for that. And you talked about the concept of American fascism. Now, I used to be one of those people that, you know, my hackles would get raised whenever somebody would say American fascism, or that idea that maybe the United States is evolving or devolving, depending on how you look at it, mm-hmm. into a fascist state. Mm-hmm. And I, because I spent most of my time as a young historian studying the Nazis, I equated fascism with Nazism. But then you realize that that was just one manifestation of fascism. Fascism, as it was originally envisioned in Italy by Mussolini, was a very corporatist state where the government and the corporations merged, if not quite a military-industrial complex, a statist military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And somebody I remember, and I can't quite remember who it was, but said fascism won't arrive in the United States in brown shirts and jackboots. It will arrive in business suits, in essence, and briefcases and corporate type of paraphernalia. Fascism arrives in each society in different guises, akin to that society. Do you think that's what's happened in the United States, that there is this – we're not talking Hitler and his brown shirts, but we're talking about something that in an American context is just as bad. And you know what? An awful lot sneakier, frankly.
Yes, absolutely. And like you, by the way, Paul, I studied the Nazi regime to an excruciating degree for many, many years. On my shelf, I'm looking at lots of books dealing with the Third Reich, and I'm very aware that academicians are very particular when you talk about fascism to say that it was a historical phenomenon, referring to Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco, and related regimes of that particular time. But I think that's taking a very parochial view of it, and I'm glad that I think you and I might be on the same page here in the sense that. Here's a question that I asked myself a number of years ago when my children were quite a bit smaller. I was watching them at a playground with a bunch of other kids, and parents are sitting down on benches, reading newspapers, listening to whatever they were doing. And I was thinking, as I often do, about the horrible state of the world, and thinking, these kids are utterly oblivious to so many of the bad things that are going on today. And, of course, that's good. They're kids. But I thought, well, how many adults really are fully aware of what is going on in their own country? And then it occurred to me that I had this question, which is, can you have a fascist state without people knowing it? Can you have an invisible fascism, so to speak? And I thought the answer to that is yes. Well, of course you can. Certainly the people who own all the goodies in this country and around the world today aren't so stupid as to throw swastikas on their troops and have them marching in brown shirts up and down the street. People would recoil to that. But you can make a fascist state much more attractive, much more sexy. Just turn on your TV, zone out, stop paying attention to what's actually going on. If you have a corporatist state, which includes, of course, mass media, which is big part of the picture, and when you have an alliance between the major media and the intelligence community, which we know has happened over more than the last 50 years, then how hard is it? There's always going to be people who wake up and resist that, but the large majority of people they don't have the time, they don't have the energy, they don't have the wherewithal to question all of that. They have jobs, they have families to raise, and so forth. And so, yes, I think that's what we can be looking at. And, this isn't 1933. It's not 1935 so fascism won't look like Hitler's version. It won't look like Mussolini's. We're in the year 2010. We're in a completely different era. And so I think we should expect that a version of fascism today would look different. It would look a little more sophisticated, as a matter of fact.
I think the mechanism that you're seeing, and I certainly don't disagree with you, I mean, perhaps on some small points, but in the general thrust, as each year passes, more and more I agree with you in the way our society is going. And I travel back in time over 2,000 years to the fall of the Roman Republic, which didn't really fall. It's not like when Hitler took over, even Mussolini, it would happen fairly quickly. The instruments of the new state were in place, in Hitler's case, quite quickly. In Mussolini's case, right. It took a little longer, and it was never fully completed. But in the Roman Empire, I mean, Augustus didn't use the title of emperor. It was so he reigned for decades without actually.
And the Senate continued to convene, and they continued to do things. I mean, toward the end, they were a little more than the city council of Rome, but the Senate continued right on through the remaining days of the empire for the next 500 years.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing is, and maybe fascism is the wrong word, although I think it's also the right word, is you're seeing an imperial America. You're seeing a republic morph into an empire, and I've always thought that after 1945, the United States simply replaced, which is ironic considering how Americans and especially Roosevelt viewed the British Empire, they basically replaced the British as the holders of the Anglo-Saxon world order, if you will, or empire.
Yeah, and so that's right.
The center of power as it transferred from Rome to Byzantium, transferred in this case from London to New York.
I think that's an excellent analogy.
Washington.
Excellent analogy. And in fact, the Brits really almost explicitly requested this in the immediate post-war years anyway, I think in 1947 relative to Greece. So, yes, I take your point and agree that, you know, what is it that we have? Is it fascism? Is it some other version of authoritarianism? I think we can quibble over the details. The reason, by the way, that I named my book UFOs and the national security state then is because it's always been important to me to try to understand the relationship between these two things. The UFO phenomenon didn't just drop into anyone's lap. It dropped, so to speak, into the lap of the American national security elite that were more than anyone else really in a position to try to deal with it.
I'll tell you what, we're being dropped into another lap here, which is called station breaks. We have Richard Dolan, our co-host Paul Kimball, and Nick Redfern. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the PowerCast. Hey neighbors, have you been thinking about starting a website? Well, I'm going to tell you about a great offer from HostGator. HostGator is a world famous leader in web hosting, and they make it easy for you to get your own .com domain name. You create your very own website with their free site builder tools and great selection of templates. Use the coupon code PowerCast. Once again, use the coupon code PowerCast and sign up at this special address, thepowercast.com/gator. That's G-A-T-O-R, thepowercast.com/gator.
Fate Magazine provides true reports of the strange and unknown. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, life after death, and much, much more. To receive your free issue of Fate Magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Normal blood pressure, naturally. How would that make you feel?
I'm Don from New Mexico. January of 2000, I had a heart attack. Then my real health began going downhill, and I had high blood pressure, high blood sugar, poor vision, and I really wasn't sleeping well. I was a mess, pretty much.
Don reports dramatic improvements with Heart and Body Extract.
I started taking Heart and Body Extract, and from within a few days, I started sleeping a lot better. My blood pressure normalized, my blood sugar normalized, and my sleep really did improve.
Experience these benefits and more when your body gets what it needs with the assistance of Heart and Body Extract. Order at hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305. That's hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305.
And folks, I did not expect this at all. By the 7th, 8th, and 9th day, I saw dramatic improvements from taking Heart and Body Extract.
Details at hbextract.com or call 866-295-5305 for Heart and Body Extract.
Where have all the military surplus stores gone? Don't worry, you don't need one, because everything you need at Military Surplus is at MainMilitary.com. That's M-A-I-N-E, Military.com, one of the last surviving true military surplus stores in the country. Go online now to MainMilitary.com and discover a source for hard-to-find surplus items at true surplus prices. Surplus gun cleaning kits as low as $2.99, complete chemical suits as low as $11.99. See our huge selection of gas masks, filters, and accessories. Finish at M10 gas masks are $3 for $30, and Swiss filters are $3 for $12. Searching for Strike Anywhere matches? MainMilitary.com has them, plus a whole new product line of survival and first aid kits and lots more. Get free shipping on orders over $50 only at MainMilitary.com. That's M-A-I-N-E, Military.com. Or call 877-608-0179, 877-608-0179. MainMilitary.com, the main name in military supply.
When you hear the words water purification, what comes to mind? If it's Berkey Water Purification Systems, this message is for you. Did you know that over 60% of municipal water contains fluoride at less than 2 cents per gallon? Berkey water filters purify treated and untreated water, remove dangerous chlorine, fluoride, and contaminants from municipal water. These filters are powerful enough to purify stagnant pond water, making them perfect for rainwater collection systems. From the smallest to the largest systems, BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com has what you need. With your system purchase, you'll receive a shower filter, a fluoride filter, or two sport Berkey bottles absolutely free. BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com would like to offer GCN listeners 5% off all ceramic filter systems and ship all orders over $50 free of charge. Visit BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com. That's BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com. Or call 1-877-99-BERKEY. That's 1-877-99-BERKEY today.
10 years.
Genesis.
A decade of talk.
Genesis.
Great Talk Radio is here on the Genesis Communications Network.
You're in the Paracast. You never know what's going to happen next.
Our guest this week, Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State, which is so far a two-volume set with a third coming sometime in the future. Our co-hosts are Nick Redfern and Paul Kimball. Now, there was an interesting story this week that has become available from the Washington Post about national security called Top Secret America, a hidden world growing beyond control. And I think Richard's going to have a comment about this. Let me read the first paragraph, okay? The top secret world the government created in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 has become so large, so unwieldy, and so secretive that no one knows how much money it costs, how many people it employs, how many programs exist within it, or exactly how many agencies do the same work. So, Richard Dolan, I ask you, is it quite possible they could have something going on in there regarding UFOs, space travel, whatever, secret space travel? We wouldn't know anything about it. We don't know what's happening in the security departments these days.
I can't prove that they do, but I believe absolutely that they do, Gene. And that is that's a great article. Everyone should read it. One of the things that I've really come to believe regarding the UFO topic and the development of the national security state is how integral, almost certainly, that the UFO secrecy has been to the creation of the black budget system that we have today. And, you know, students of the American black budget, I think, in general, they don't appreciate just how important the UFO topic is to this field. For example, if I mentally rewind the clock back to the late 1940s and pretend that I'm Harry Truman, and some of my top people have come to me and informed me that this phenomenon of flying saucers is real, and that apparently we've recovered, which I think has happened, technology that wasn't manufactured by human hands. So let's just pretend that that did happen. If it did, certainly what I would need to do is to organize my top people around me and to say, you know, let's figure this out, and maybe break down the division of labor. So one person's job will be to, you know, control the media aspects of it. One person's job will be to try to find out how bad the public panic might be. And another person's job would be to find a way for industry to study this technology so that we could do something with it, and so forth. And this is where I think the black budget comes in, because if you're going to develop some kind of scientific R&D infrastructure to study acquired technology, you obviously can't let the Soviets know about it in this early period of the Cold War, and that means you really can't let Congress know about it, because even if some congressmen know about it, it's almost certainly going to leak at some point. So the idea would be that this has to be ultra, ultra secret. And what that means, of course, is an end run around your formal constitutional practices. You have to do it in your own eyes in order to fund a program that nobody can know about. And what if it turns out to be a fairly expensive program? So what you have, in other words, in the late 1940s, I think, is the genesis of a black budget, much of which concerned the UFO topic. And so the UFO phenomenon has a very integral relationship to the United States black budget, I would argue. And so now with articles like that have come out in the Post, where we're dealing with I was going to say an invisible empire, but it's not so invisible. It's a completely sprawling empire that is answerable basically to no one, to no citizen. Yes, I think we can trace a lot of this to the UFO phenomenon 60 years ago.
Okay, so let's look at some of the broader aspects here. The thing that worries me about these long-term government programs is how do you continue them from administration to administration? We know maybe the president doesn't know. Maybe Congress doesn't know. But we know that military leadership is going to be changing over the years. So how do you keep this going from one degree to another, of one set of leadership to another set of leadership?
Well, I've asked this question as well. I was fortunate enough to have a chat a couple of times. It's actually become sort of friendly now. A gentleman who was a very high-level CIA official. This man knows more than one U.S. president. I know that. I think he's a good guy. He's a very, very intelligent man. And I had the opportunity to ask him, how much do U.S. presidents know about this topic? You know, every researcher who's got a chance to ask this, I think, would probably want to ask it. So I thought I would run this by him. And his answer was, well, some know more than others. He said, you know, think of it this way. Presidents come and presidents go. Some of them are around for 4 years, some maybe eight. Some are emotionally stable, others not so much. He said, some drink. He said that to me. Some are just not reliable. And he says there are career people involved in this, and they're here forever. He said, so the question is, how much does a president, how much can a president know, and how much should a president know? And one thing, you know, logistically speaking, when you're dealing with all of the black budget programs that we have, hundreds and hundreds, it's actually just almost impossible for any sitting president to be briefed on all of these. He's got to go around kissing the baby, shaking hands, attending G20 meetings, and so on. It's really not in the president's capability to comprehend all of these black budget programs, and the UFO topic is one of these. So who's running it? Well, here's what it looks like to me. It looks to me that over the decades, just as has happened with many other facets of the intelligence community, that much of this has gone private, more and more private. Now, that doesn't mean that there is no government interaction with the UFO topic. But I think my guideline for understanding this is an article that I read, came out about 10 years ago by aviation writer Bill Sweetman. Bill Sweetman did a study of special access programs, in other words, of the black budget. And what he argued, what he discovered, he said, was that the black budget programs that are within the Pentagon increasingly are dominated by the private contractors, not by the Pentagon personnel, that the dominant decision makers were the corporations, whether they're Lockheed, Boeing, Raytheon, and so forth, not the Pentagon liaisons, who increasingly functioned primarily as gatekeepers for money, as funding conduits, but often not a lot more. Now, that was Sweetman's conclusion regarding just special, you know, standard black budget programs. But the individuals that I've been able to speak with who tell me that they've had connection with UFO-related black budget programs have said essentially the same type of thing, that this is something in which formal government channels increasingly are out of the loop. And really, I ask myself, is that so hard to believe? You look at how American foreign policy has been conducted over the past several decades, and it's only got the most thin veneer of political independence. It's really running for, as I see it, and I think a lot of people see it, for international financial groups that basically strong-arm the government into doing what they want it to do. So I don't think it's any different relating to the UFO topic.
It's interesting when you mention that. I'm just looking at that Top Secret America Washington Post article, and on the first page it says, among their investigation's findings include that some 1,000 – this is sobering stuff – some 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies work on programs related to counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence in about 10,000 locations across the United States.
God almighty.
So there's a couple of things you could take out of that. One, there's more private companies by a factor of about 1.5 than government organizations working on, let's say, homeland security intelligence operations.
Mm-hmm.
And two, if you live anywhere in the United States, they're probably doing it in your town in some
way
or another. So,
well, they're certainly doing it in Arizona, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, if you're wondering where the U.S. national security apparatus is, walk down your main street and take a look, because that's probably where it is. And that should be sobering to anybody. And if you – so to all those people who say, well, where – and again, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. In fact, I tend to disagree about some of the UFO conclusions, even as I keep an open mind. But one of the reasons why I would keep an open mind is when you look at a statistic like that, it's very – difficult for me to give credence to somebody who would just give a blank denial and say, well, the U.S. government could never keep those kinds of secrets, could they? Well, of course they could. There's 1,931 private companies they can bury it in, and there's 1,271 government organizations they can bury it in, and parts of it in. So if you compartmentalize it, then you can at least make a legitimate, rational case, I think, that if there is alien technology, it could be covered up. That leaves us, of course, with the question of whether there is alien technology that we've uncovered or not. But if you can prove that to me, I have no problem believing that it could be buried somewhere right next to the Ark of the Covenant on Main Street in Topeka, Kansas.
It's not in Warehouse 13 then, Paul, right? Hey, I got to tell everybody, we have Richard Dolan joining us this week on the Paracast. If you want to find out more of what we do, go to theparacast.com with a T-H-E, theparacast.com, our co-host this week, Nick Redfern. And Paul Kimball, I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the Paracast.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you own an Apple iPhone and love to listen to your favorite programs on GCN, I've got good news for you. I'm proud to announce that GCN has a brand new iPhone app available for our dedicated listeners at GCNLive.com. Listen to your favorite hard-hitting GCN programs live or on demand right on your iPhone. And the best part? The GCN iPhone app can be yours absolutely free. Download the iPhone app today by clicking on the banner at GCNLive.com. Again, that's GCNLive.com. Hi. This is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.